All right. Welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again. It is the Dom and Colin podcast. I am Colin alongside Dom. It is the Survivor off season, which is particularly good news this time around. I think we're all ready for a little break from that. But I would also say it is good news because that gives us more time now to dive back into talk about some documentaries again, something that we've been doing for the last year or two, somewhere in that neighborhood, whenever we get a chance. And it is a lot easier to do when Survivor isn't in season. And that's what we're here for today. We are going to be talking about, from 2004, at this point, kind of a classic documentary, but one of our favorites for a long time at this point. It is called Word Wars. Dom, can you give a brief synopsis and kind of give the elevator pitch for why people may want to check out this documentary?
So this is about the deep and dark world of competitive Scrabble, which may sound like an oxymoron, any two parts of that, but this is actually a really great documentary. And I do remember discussing this way back when this whole podcast was in its infancy. I can't quite remember if it was I who alerted you to this or the other way around, but I definitely remember discussing this and earmarking it as something which, if we ever got round to discussing documentaries, maybe this is one of the ones that should be at the top of the list. And it's finally made its way to the top, and I can't be more excited to talk about this because this really is a classic.
Yeah, it was you who alerted I to it, and I was very happy that you did. Yeah, this is very straightforward. We are tracking the 2002 U.S. National Scrabble Championship, and in particular, tracking four of like the top contenders about 9 months out, and their preparation and some of the kind of preliminary events along the way, and more importantly, their interactions with each other, and just getting to know them as people is really the focus of this movie. Yes, the big tournament does come at the end, but I would say the main focus today is going to be on the characters themselves, because we have a great group here.
Yeah, and I will say as well that this is based on a book from 2001 called Word Freak by Stefan Fatsis, which even if you don't end up watching or really enjoying the documentary, I would definitely recommend reading. There's a ton of backstory in there, not just about the game of Scrabble, but also about the cast of characters, the whole competitive scene. And if you enjoyed this, then you'll love the book because it lets you explore that world much further.
Okay, I knew that name. And when I saw him pop up in the documentary, I thought it was just like a coincidence that he shared a name with someone. But okay, that's the guy.
Right, yeah. And with a premise like this, there's always this question of how much do you need to know or care about Scrabble itself or whatever the competitive endeavor or subculture is in order to enjoy the documentary. And knowing nothing about it coming in, I still fell in love with the documentary and then was inspired to find out more about it, which is how I arrived at the book. So I think this is one of those times where the characters themselves are compelling enough and the storytelling is good and the story they're telling is good that even if you are not one of the few people, I don't hesitate to say, who have a deep interest in tournament Scrabble, you're still going to have a great time watching this.
Yeah, I would say you would be totally fine if you've literally never played Scrabble once in your life. I think you would still enjoy pretty much every single thing the movie has to offer.
Yeah, and one of the distinctions that's highlighted very early on is that the game as played in your grandmother's parlor and the game as played at the top levels of the competitive scene, it's like night and day. You know, it's the same game mechanics, basically. It's the same words, the same dictionaries that can be used. But the actual form of the board, the contours of the game after you see it play out, are completely different. So there are a lot of those games where once you understand the basic premise, you kind of can follow along with what the pros are doing if you end up watching one of those games. But Scrabble, it's going to be full of words that you've literally never seen before. And even if you had seen them, you would never use them. They basically only exist as artifacts for the game of Scrabble.
Right. Yeah. These are really the James Holzhauers of the Scrabble word. They just get paid a little bit less for their abilities.
Yeah. The hourly rate, maybe not even a hundredth of James's, as it turns out. But they're still putting in the hours and on the grind regardless.
Yeah. So I would definitely recommend, if you have the time, do check this documentary out. The easiest way that I have been able to find for people to watch it is just if you Google Watch Wars Free or whatever, like just Google Watch Word Wars 2004 and it will be the top result. There's this site, it's called like Tubi, and you just click there. it'll make you turn off whatever ad blocker you use. But other than that, there are no like pop-ups or anything. And it is certainly worth the 80 minutes or however long this actually runs. I would say to know what we're going to be talking about if you have the time to do so. But we certainly understand that plenty of people are going to just be listening to this podcast, not having seen it. And we will try to be mindful of that. But for anyone who wants to stay...
Are we? Because I'm not sure how we're going to take those people into account, honestly.
No, I was just going to say, anyone who wants to stay unspoiled, I would just say tune out now if you want to be like totally clean watching this for the first time. But otherwise, it shouldn't be too big of an issue, just kind of having people roll with and taking our word for it that the things happened as we say they did.
Yeah, and that is, I think, the best way to find it. It's always confused me a little bit when people say, well, it's not on iTunes or it's not on Netflix. I guess it's going to be impossible to find. We can write that one off. Usually you can find it out there, and you may risk your computer contracting various contagious diseases along the way, but if you're willing to take the risk, and I think you definitely should for Word Wars, then you can find it out there.
Again,
for sure.
Don't complain to me, I guess, if there somehow is a virus you get from watching this, but from what I could tell, there is no risk. Don't worry about getting... any sort of virus, you should be fine. Thank you, Dom, for your impeccable salesmanship as usual.
I just don't want to mislead people, you know. No one's going to accuse us of false advertising.
Yeah, I'm not signing any kind of liability waivers or anything, but I do think you should be okay. So let's do it, Dom. Let's get into Word Wars. And I think the way to do this is just kind of set up the four leads of this movie so people can kind of get familiar with the names we're going to be talking about along the way. And the place I want to start is with Matt Graham, who is kind of the... as I can tell, just prototypical Scrabble degenerate who we first meet as he's like arriving late for his first match. He's overslept. He's got a t-shirt on that's at least 20 years old and full of holes. And he seems like, as one might expect, a very smart guy. But a theme that we're going to notice with a lot of these characters is maybe some people who are not necessarily realizing their full potential here.
Yeah, so among the four of them, Matt is the one who I think most obviously could pass for a normal human being. He's got that that relatable kind of quality about him that anyone who's been involved in competitive gaming of any kind, whether it's Scrabble or poker, anything like that, will know 100 Matt Grahams. People who could definitely fit into normal society if they so chose, but they have this like slight degen streak about them, which was just metastasized to take over their entire being, and so now they devote every waking hour to Scrabble or poker or whatever their endeavor of choice is. That just becomes their singular focus in life, is being the best they can possibly be at that one thing, and warping their life, their bodies, their minds, whatever they have to warp in order to get there.
Yeah, Matt seems very into like brain efficiency. He's got dozens of pyramid schemes worth of like brain power pill bottles just lining his apartment next to all of his books about words, and it really seems like his solitary focus, as is the case for most people at this tier of the game, is improving every day at Scrabble, and nothing else really seems to matter to him.
And at least in Matt's case, it sounds like that streak is mostly self-contained. So there are definitely others, including among these four, who you can imagine being the ones to sell people like Matt the mind-enhancing substances that he so craves. But Matt doesn't seem to be evangelizing about them to other people. He's not trying to like get other people to come around to his mindset or his way of life, possibly because he recognizes that it doesn't actually work, certainly not for him, and possibly not for other people too. But this is, you know, anything that gives him a remote chance, anything that promises glory, he's gonna snap up and at least give it a try, because why
not?
In
an effort to kind of make this easier on the people who haven't seen it, I've recast these four leads as like the Hollywood actors that would play them if they made a fictionalized version of this movie. And Matt Graham is played by an Oz era Dean Winters. So Dean Winters from like 20 years ago. And Dom, I know you don't know who that is because you don't watch quality shows. Like, he is the Vulture on Brooklyn Nine-Nine. He was Dennis Duffy on 30 Rock. He's now famously Mayhem in those Allstate commercials. But 20 years ago, he looked exactly like Matt Graham. And I mean that as honestly a big compliment to Matt Graham. Dean Winters is a really good looking, normal looking guy. And Matt Graham We'll see late in this movie. One of his t-shirts apparently gives in entirely to all of the holes, and he's going without it for a little bit. And we can see Matt Grimm is shredded. It seems like I may have misspoken a little bit in saying that Scrabble is all he cares about, because this guy has got a insane like six-pack.
I thought when you said one of his t-shirts, you meant his one t-shirt. It feels like he has a fairly minimal wardrobe going on here. But yeah, I think this ties into the whole self-improvement thing, where you see this a lot, actually, where people who are involved at the highest levels in some kind of mental competition or activity, they extend that attitude and that discipline to other areas of their life. And I know, especially for some people, it's part of acquiring that strength in the mental part as well. It's, you know, if your body is operating at high capacity, then your mind will as well. And I think there's definitely some truth to that, but some people take it to the real extreme, and it's like, unless they are in the gym 5 hours a day, then why bother spending those 5 hours behind the dictionaries instead, because that's not going to do anything for you.
And we also learn along the way about Matt that he has like loved and lost a little bit, and came really close potentially to like getting a job writing comedy for Conan O'Brien back when he was doing Late Night. And we see, I thought it was very interesting, a clip of Matt doing like some stand-up himself. And it's so funny that in 2002, which is when this is being shot, the guy bringing him out on stage, as like, he's just like spending the night hosting at the Laugh Factory or whatever, is the now very famous Mike Birbiglia, who was like not very well known back then. It's so funny that he's got a cameo in this movie, which was released long before he was even that famous.
Who's going to play Mike Birbiglia in the biopic version of this? Is it going to be Mike Birbiglia himself, or are we going to draft somebody else in?
Mike Birbiglia looks a little different after these last 15 years or so.
Right. But once again, when you said he's doing this comedy set at the Laugh Factory and it's so funny, I thought you were going to stop there and be praising his comedy.
But instead, his bit about like the cat knocking things over.
It was pretty good. If we workshop that, I think there's some real potential there here in 2019. But you are never given a conclusive answer, really. And I don't think you could get one. Definitely not for Matt himself. I don't think he's fully reliable on this, over what the chicken is there and what's the egg. Like, did he lose out on other opportunities, and did he lose those people in his life because he was singularly focused on Scrabble at the expense of all other things? Or did missing out on those send him into this tailspin where Scrabble became his form of escapism, which then took over his life and became his his all-abiding passion?
Yeah, it doesn't seem clear from the movie, but the impression I get from Matt, both right away and continuing along pretty much the entirety of the movie, is when things start going poorly for him, he is not great at handling that. And as good as he is when he's in a solid state of mind, is almost irrelevant compared to the damage he does when he's in a bad state of mind.
And he has this almost objective or kind of dispassionate view of his own mistakes, where you see him when he's discussing them, he's not really tilting off visibly, right? He's not giving into frustration the way that Marlon does. He's not, you know, expressing that, wearing that on his sleeve, but he is beating himself up over making those mistakes. And you get the sense that it's not that he's making those mistakes, it's that he's made similar mistakes in the past and can't correct that process in his mind to stop him from making those again. And he's angry at himself that he can't seem to fix whatever the flaw is there, as opposed to he's mad because his opponents got lucky and drew the right tiles, or that he missed an obvious bingo or anything like that. It's something deeper that he keeps coming back to, which is gnawing at
him. Yeah, he seems like he has some hangups that may surface at inopportune moments and that he has a hard time overlooking. But, you know, there are plenty of good things for Matt along the way that we certainly will get to. But let's get into, just quickly at least, the other leads here in this cast. And you just alluded to this guy, Marlon, who, Dom, in just briefly talking a little bit with you off air, it seems like you and I may be on the same page here, which is that Marlon is the real star of this movie.
Absolutely. When we're talking about the leads, you would be burying the lead if you didn't talk about Marlon first. He is truly sensational, and he's one of those people for whom the fact that he is amazing at high-level Scrabble is somehow not even one of the most interesting things about him. You know, he's just this incredibly compelling character who, if he was interested in anything else, I would want a documentary to be made about that instead, because I just want more Marlon on my screen at all times.
Yeah, Marlon is going to be played by Kenan Thompson. Kenan's going to grow the dreck like Kenan Kell days and tackle this Marlon role. Do you know who Kenan Thompson is?
No clue whatsoever.
Okay, cool. He's only been on TV for 25 years. That's fine. Yeah, Marlon is...
Look, in my defense, at the time of Word Wars airing, he'd only been on TV for 10 years. So you can give me some leeway there.
Sure. So Marlon is from New York City, and he is a titan in that kind of local Scrabble scene, and has had a couple like decent tournaments along the way to test himself on like the highest stage here. And I do mean highest, because Marlon is not afraid to play a little Scrabble under the influence.
And the entire Hill family really pull through here. So we meet Uncle Harrison later, who seems very amiable, and he's like the good cop to the bad cop in the bad cops in the family, where like you can tell he doesn't quite understand how he got himself into this like sitcom-esque situation, but here he is. And yeah, for as much as Marlon is like venting to him and at him at all times, he takes it with good humor, or so it would seem. And then you have Marlon's mom, Hattie Hill, who Marlon is the star of this documentary, but she is like the co-star. She is the Patty to his Jonathan. You know, she really comes through strong.
So I wasn't sure. I shouldn't step on this by acknowledging how much I like it this early, because then you'll stop doing it. But I love the way you say Marlon.
Oh, I know. I knew you would as well, but there's no other way I can say it, because that's just how it's said. So I'm having to live my truth out here and hope that I'm not being pilloried by the masses for it.
Yeah, I love along the entire documentary, it seems Marlon and Matt know really well. Marlon, at least, is not really not someone who wants to call them friends necessarily, but they are like rooming together at these various tournaments, and it is a lot of fun to see the dynamic between Marlon and Matt over the course of this movie.
It's wonderful, yeah. And I'm not sure if Matt would call them friends either. He says midway through the documentary, "Now that I'm taking care of my shit, I don't need this kind of symbiotic misery," which I think is a fantastic way of putting it. But again, anyone who has been involved in something like that will recognize and probably have those friendships where they're not friendships necessarily, and you're not sure if you even like the person, but due to a mixture of just convenience and them being one of the few people who understands the scene the way that you do, and just needing to have some kind of companionship, which is just better than loneliness when you're on the grind like that, you end up being around these people who in any other circumstances you would not want or bring into your life, but they're just there and you have to make the best of it and grow to accept them for who they are insofar as you even can.
I mean, I feel like you're overtly talking about me at this point.
What? It's all about you, Colin. Not everything is a subtweet.
Yeah. No, so Marlon is a ton of fun along the way here. And so I guess we should also talk a little bit about Joe Edley, who is played by Larry David. Dom, you of course know who Larry David is,
yes,
please, right?
Yes. I'm not going to disappoint you that far. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you said that Matt seemed like the one who was potentially most able to blend in with normal humans, I would have said Joe is the one who stood out to me as most. I will absolutely grant he has some quirks about him. It seems like he did like most adept at fitting into at least having a normal life around him, where we see he has a wife and kids that come with him to these tournaments. He at least has a job that he drives back and forth to and studies Scrabble while not looking at the road the entire time that he's driving, and it's horrifying. But hilariously, the big villain of like the Scrabble world, because he's the three-time national champion and everyone knows who he is, and haters are going to hate, I suppose, because he seems just like by far the least abrasive of the main group.
That's interesting. I might have said long-suffering wife and kids. That's never made quite clear. But yeah, I think with Joe, it's not about the fact that he's so successful, although I'm sure that's what he would tell you. It's just the fact that he does seem kind of, I don't know if annoying really captures it properly, but he has this kind of like California hippie mindset where if you just believe in yourself and go through the right process, then you can like ascend to a higher plane or something. And you can imagine Joe as like a wannabe cult leader or one of those guys who's selling Matt Graham some, you know, fish oil on the pretense that it's actually some like wonder drug or something.
Do you mean like maliciously? Because to me, I never got the sense that Joe Edley had a harmful bone in his body.
Oh, no, I think he fully buys into his own self-promotion, right? I don't think he's a grifter in that sense. He's just someone who knows that he's good at this and is not afraid of sharing the fact that he's very good at this and reveling in that fact and making sure that everyone else knows it too.
Yeah, and you alluded to his kind of hippie vibe. I would say he has like the Phil Jackson kind of old white guy who's into like Zen yoga thing going, but no one tells him how kind of weird it looks on him because he's so unbelievably successful.
Yeah, I wonder if his wife has at one point had a conversation like, look, dear, I don't know if you know this, but what you're doing is maybe not going down so well. And I seemingly he has not internalized that message because he continues doing it. And I guess it continues to work for him. So who are we to judge, Colin? And just quickly as well, it's worth noting that the one major success that we're told about and that we keep rehashing is the 1980 World Championship, I believe, which even when this documentary was airing back in 2004, this was a long time ago. This was 25 years in the past. And now in 2019, we're getting on for 40 years there. So that's a long and storied career in Scrabble. But you don't know if he's someone who his flame was burning bright at the start of his career, and then he's tried to live off that 15 minutes of fame for as long as possible, or if he has had this sustained success that has kept him in that Hall of Fame across that entire span.
Yeah, it's unclear. We did hear about his backstory during the segment about the Scrabble dictionary. They said the official Scrabble dictionary came out in 1978, and then it cut off his backstory of like when that happened. I recognized this could be a big thing. I'm memorizing this immediately and stopped memorizing words. And so I would say his edge has probably even gone down over time compared to what it once was. But you know, I don't have the years in front of me. He's still revered at the time of this filming as one of the best players in the world. I would guess that Joe Edley has been a behemoth for pretty much the entirety of those 25 years.
Yeah, you can tell when that guy stops Joe in the bathroom at one point to brag about having beat Joe Edley. There's a level of being starstruck in his voice. You can tell that he's really pleased to have got that. But it's also like, thank God I beat Joe Edley, because otherwise he would have been insufferable about it. So there's a respect, but you don't know how much of it is a grudging respect.
Right, the guy he's playing, spoiler alert, later on. Oh, no, excuse me. I'm confusing that with something else. But when we get to that, and that has to do with our final lead character here, who is a man by the name of Joel. And the GI stands for exactly what you think it stands for, gastrointestinal Joel, who has like acid reflux, among other things, that make him, as he would put it, almost physically incapable of doing anything other than playing Scrabble.
Yeah, he has a fairly haunting almost insight where there's this monologue of him just going through a building in this ill-fitting coat, which he's like shuffling back and forth on his shoulders as he strides at warp speed through the thing. And you don't see anyone else like glancing sideways at him, but you think they have to be. And it's just like the way he carries himself, the way he acts, you can tell he's someone who doesn't really feel fully integrated into the society that he's in, and then also his actual like physical health problems and everything else explain and justify that and flesh that out even further. And we'll play the clip here, but he says he's done very little to contribute to society for most of his life, and he's not wrong, but you get the sense that he's the kind of guy who would be underselling himself and would be self-deprecating. And even if he was this loved figure in the community, which it seems like he is, it seems like people genuinely are rooting for his success and want him to do well and are respecting him, he wouldn't be able to even understand that or understand the depth of it.
Or at least he didn't strike me as the type that if he were up to a whole lot more, he would be like going out of his way to downplay it. I think he has faced the fact decades ago that his whole life is Scrabble. Let's roll the clip now of Joel essentially just giving us his life story.
I never applied myself that hard to anything I ever did in my life besides Scrabble. I never succeeded in any other endeavor. I have done very little to contribute to society most of my life. I was a college dropout. I felt I had learned everything I needed to know in order to get by in this life in kindergarten when I knew how to read. I don't have a real life as compared to most people I know and even most Scrabble players I know. How a typical day goes for me, I sleep while the sun is shining, and then I get up and eventually play a few games of Scrabble, and that's the day. Every Thursday night, I run National Scrabble Association Club number 56 in New York City. My particular club is frequented by the most competitive players around. There's very little else I'm actually qualified to do at this point, and playing Scrabble is actually the only thing my body will allow me to sit still and do for a period of time without major interruptions.
And on top of that, we also hear when we meet Marlon, Marlon says, we don't need to play the audio, but he says, quote, "I do nothing for a living. I make no living. I'm happily poor," end quote. And as alluded to earlier, Matt does not seem to have a whole lot else going on. And that, as I mentioned near the top of this podcast, seems to be one of the kind of running themes in the high level Scrabble world itself, which is to get to that point. It seems like you have to dedicate way more time to getting good at Scrabble than is even close to financially responsible to dedicating that amount of time.
And again, this comes back to most competitive sports, esports. Scrabble's not even either of those, just activities, I guess, where for a lot of them, they can become this endless time sink and money sink if you want them to be. There's no kind of limit on how deep you can go or how far you can go to dedicate yourself to being the best at that. And I don't know if, like, on their deathbeds, they will look back and think, I wish I hadn't devoted 40 years of my life to playing Scrabble, but then it's not clear what the alternative exactly is. So if Joel had this normal white-collar job in the city that he commuted to every day, and he was leaving home early and getting home late, and he was miserable the entire time he was there, I think by normal metrics, he would have contributed more to society. But again, is that the kind of thing that you're going to look back on and be happy about? Or, you know, are you going to be glad that you did that for your entire life? Or do you wish that you had pursued the thing that you really love and which brings you happiness? And I guess there's an element of the grass is always greener on the other side, in part because you don't know what the grass even looks like until you're there and you're too deep to come back to the other side after that. But I think this goes for all of them, really. It's like, I'm sure they could be doing more productive things with their time, and maybe there's something else out there that would make them happier, but they don't know what that is, and we don't know what that is. And so it's very easy to say, well, why don't you just go get a real job? And we'll come back to that theme a little bit later on. But it's, again, that's easy to say and much harder to put into practice.
Right. My takeaway from watching all of these people is, you couldn't pay them to stop playing Scrabble all the time, essentially. Maybe Marlon, you could, but it definitely seems like something is motivating them to spend virtually all of their free time and more time than they should necessarily be having free on this and only this. And I did want to just quickly add that G.I. Joel is played by Tony Hale, who, Dom, you know as Gary from Veep, but most would know as Buster Bluth from Arrested Development. Really, I think the biggest no-brainer of this entire cast was Tony Hale as G.I. Joel, and I'm positive he would knock that role out of the park. And Dom, you really undersold the montage of G.I. Joel walking around some building in a giant trench coat. Like, the way he walks, I think, really tells you a lot about him. It's impossible to really do justice to it, but there's so much like shoulder action going back and forth, and way faster than normal, blowing past everyone walking along the same side of the hallway as him. There's a lot going on here with G.I. Joel that I think reveals itself in ways beyond just the words he says. I think the full element is goes on the gastrointestinal stuff. Like, I think part of that could be, is psychosomatic the right word? Where when he's describing how Scrabble is the only thing that he can even sit through, part of me wonders if that's just his body not liking doing anything other than playing Scrabble.
Yeah, there's an unsettling urgency to it almost that's hard to really describe. And this is one of those times where we wish we could embed video clips in the middle of a podcast just so people could really understand what we're talking about. But when you go and watch a documentary, even if we hadn't highlighted, that would definitely stand out because it's really hard to ignore, even though it's just the backdrop to a monologue and it's not meant to be the focus whatsoever.
Yeah, and incidentally, though, maybe I am underselling him again in terms of only wanting to pursue Scrabble the same way. It seems like Matt Graham at least has time to work out. G.I. Joel certainly has time to practice the piano, a very talented pianist. It is yet another thing that makes me wonder just how much Scrabble may have been kind of eating into all that he could have done if he were not so caught up on Scrabble.
He strikes me as the type of guy who is very good at things that he puts his mind to, but the health problems and other things means that he can't fit that into a conventional schedule. So maybe he would be a great pianist, but if he has to travel extensively and work grueling hours that he can't control and so on, then maybe that trade-off just isn't worth it for him. Whereas with Scrabble, he does his duties as the president of the local association every Thursday or whatever, and then he goes to these tournaments sometimes. But outside of that, he gets to set his own hours, and most of those he can spend sleeping or playing Scrabble or whatever. And that's kind of the life that he's chosen for himself, but also the life that he feels forced into by his position. Like he has some awkward cards, and he's playing them the only way he knows how.
I mean, I would say, based on how good he has gotten while dedicating almost all of his time to Scrabble, I would guess that Joel were lucky enough to have loved the piano instead of Scrabble and had dedicated half as many hours to playing the piano as he has to Scrabble. Like, if that had been what he wanted to do instead, he would have been far better off and made far more money playing the piano than playing Scrabble.
Is he actually that good at the piano, or is it that because neither of us is good at the piano, we just see someone playing the piano competently and assign some kind of genius to it?
It's not necessarily that he's so at it, but I can't imagine he's put that much time into it, and seems at least decent enough that if he were dedicating 6 hours a day to the piano instead of 12 hours a day to Scrabble, that would serve him way better.
But that's the thing, right? He has got to the point where he is one of the best in the world at Scrabble, and so that rewards him the way that that position does. If he was, let's say, a second to third tier pianist, there's no equivalent fame or success, right? If he is so good that he's being booked to play in sold out concert halls and he's working alongside some of the best musicians in the world, okay, great, he's got it made and he'll have a successful and fulfilling career doing that. But if he's someone who is having to teach students that maybe he doesn't like that very much just to bring the money in, or having to take on any gig he can find because he lives in New York and that's what he needs to do to not get evicted, then I don't know if that's much better or that's going to make him that much happier.
I agree. It's not going to make him nearly as happy. It's just that being the number one Scrabble player in the world is worth very little compared to being a mid-level piano player, pianist.
Right, and it's worth noting the economics of all of this here, because there are various games or sports or activities where enough money has been pumped into it by the people in charge or the people who are organizing the contests that it does make sense financially to dedicate yourself to doing that if realistically you can expect to do well most of the time. So a lot of the esports craze nowadays, or most of the major sports or major games or whatever, like if you are one of the best chess players in the world, obviously it makes sense to do that because you're going to have the money coming in. If you're a second to third tier chess player, then maybe not so much. And the same goes for like tennis or God knows what. You can name basically anything there.
But at least those are things where you can make a very solid living coaching.
Yeah, and that's what I was getting to as well, where there's this whole ecosystem sprung up there, where because those activities have enough cultural traction and prestige, people want to be good at them and people want their kids to be good at them, so they're willing to fork over large sums of money to hire people who are good at them to teach their kids to be good at them.
Right.
Whereas with Scrabble, it's a nice talking point over dinner if your kid's good at Scrabble. You're not going to be shelling out for a coach packing all of that in among his other extracurricular activities so that your kid can be the world's 100th best Scrabble player.
Right.
So the incentives just don't really line up there. And this is one thing that Word Freak, the Stefan Fazis book, goes into in a lot of detail, where in this attempt to build up a competitive scene, you have Hasbro and the various people up and down the ranks of whoever's owned Scrabble at any time who are trying to make it work, but maybe are not that invested. Whereas you have the people like Marlon and Matt and Joel who basically, no matter what the tournament structure is or what the payoff is, as long as they are not going broke and going hungry, they will be at every tournament. You know, they are on the grind. They will make it work somehow, even if it's not healthy or responsible for them to do it. And with that in mind, you don't really need to entice those people with a lot of money because they're going to be turning up anyway. And this is the problem that a lot of developing competitive gaming scenes have, where the incentives for the people who are making the rules and the incentives for the people who are following the rules just don't line up. There's a very like uneven negotiating position, which warps what ends up happening.
Right. And the reason for that is the fish, the people who are the losing players in the long run, they cannot win nearly often enough to maintain a functioning ecosystem. The same way you're one of the, 25 or so best chess players in the world, you're probably a chess coach rather than making a living winning money by playing chess, because people don't play chess for high stakes. There's no variance in chess the way that there is in, for instance, poker, which after all these decades, kind of booming ecosystem all over the place, because any given hand, the worst player at the table can get the full stack from the best player at the table.
And the quote that opens the documentary is, in this game, you can be God if you've got the right tiles. And they don't explain the rules or the mechanics of Scrabble in great detail. So for the uninformed listener, you're never really given an answer on how much of the game is skill versus variance. So if I'm like a middling local club level Scrabble player, I go up against Joel or Joe Edley or some of these other great players, how likely am I to win or to steal a game? And is that what I have to do? Do I have to hope for some like freak accident in order to win? Or is it the kind of thing where, you know, even if I go up against the best in the world, I still have a decent shot on any given day of putting out the win?
So I would say there would be way more money in Scrabble if the tournament worked is everyone draws a random opponent, you all play one game, and whoever puts up the high score wins the tournament. And in that case, whoever draws the best tiles is indeed God. But when it's a scenario like the national championship, and by the way, that is much more, that opening case is a lot like how a poker tournament goes. Complete fish can win the World Series main event. It's unbelievable how much money bad players win in a week if they get, which happens all the time in poker. But of course, of a U.S. national championship, you play 31 games and score the entire time, and there is, I can't fathom a scenario where a recreational player has even like made the final four or whatever in this tournament. In the long run, which is certainly realized by the end of one of these championship events, the losing players have absolutely no equity.
Yeah, this tournament is a real marathon, and I don't know if all tournaments are that long or follow the same structure, but based on what we've seen from this national championship, if you want to do well, you have to do well consistently and over a prolonged period of time. And if you don't have the skill or the stamina, that will be exposed over the course of the days of the tournament. But you do still have these high stakes situations towards the end, where you see Marlon say towards the beginning, he came second at the Nationals back in 96. If he came in first, that's another $15,000 on top, which is literally life-changing money for Marlon, right? And so, you know, for as much as you have to slog through the 30 games previously to get to that point, and your skill or lack thereof will show over time there, if you draw bad tiles in the finals against someone who's slightly worse than you, they can very easily win, and that's the end of your tournament, and that can be a career defining win.
Yeah,
or loss.
And I have friends who are hardcore Words with Friends grinders, and I dabbled in that scene for a few months, but they were just way too good and intense for me, and I was never winning, no matter how good I drew. But at least in the matches between them playing each other, it quite often just comes down to who draws what are known as the power tiles, the high value tiles that when played optimally, if you get, you know, like five of the six big money tiles, it's very hard to overcome how the points you can put up if you have an opportunity to use those efficiently. And it seemed like that would be the variance that they would be referring to when talking about matches played between like the highest level players. Like, for instance, when we see that like home game between G.I. Joel and Matt Graham for $1,000, Matt eventually concedes, just saying he's getting outpicked so badly.
Yeah, if you paid Matt money to quit Scrabble, he would take it and then spew it all the way to Joel in those house games of Scrabble. But yeah, there's a talk by a game designer, Richard Garfield, just on what it takes to really quantify the degree to which skill and luck play a part in games. And I'll link that in the show notes because I think that gets into the topic in a more articulate and informed way than we could hope to, and we don't want to spend the hour that he does on that one topic alone. But it is the kind of thing where there is enough variance in the game for people to tell themselves as a kind of palliative thing, oh, I just lost because the other guy outdrew me and I got unlucky. But there's also enough skill that the people who do grind and do put the hours in are showing consistent results. And so when we see some of these names who aren't the main focus of the documentary, but who pop up later, like Nigel Richards, Brian Cappelletto, and a few others, it's seen as no surprise at all that, yeah, here they are dominating yet another tournament, because that's just what we've come to expect from them nowadays.
Yeah, so you just brought up the name Brian Cappelletto. When we talked about Som, that there were other people in their like wine sommelier study group that would pop up occasionally, and I had posited that because of their like results within the final exam, they had probably tracked other people who didn't like make the final cut as lead characters of the movie. And it stood out to me that I'm guessing there was a ton of Brian Cappelletto backstory that we didn't see too much of that could have otherwise made it had he been the one to ultimately win like the national championship. Because along the preliminary tournaments that we track, he, I believe, wins two of the like four prelims along the way. And I'm guessing is someone they had a microphone up to whenever they could to get into the mind of this Scrabble guru.
I wonder how much Nigel Richards was left on the cutting room floor as well.
From New Zealand, and the championship was his first ever tournament in America, or like using the American English dictionary. That they made a big deal out of that. And incidentally, now that when I was researching the major championships over the last several years to see if any of these people have been doing a lot of winning, he is the one who has just been dominating the Scrabble scene. He is presented when we eventually get to that championship tournament as like, oh, the Aji from New Zealand who may struggle now to use the American spellings only. He's going to be able to sort them out. Is he going to know where they're legal or not? And it seems like over in the years after this documentary has come out, this guy has won like every single major tournament four or five times.
I was going to say, I have the 538 article here entitled "What Makes Nigel Richards the Best Scrabble Player on Earth?" And an excerpt from that, this is back in 2014. So this begins, "He is currently ranked first in North America. The difference between his official rating and the second place players is about the same as the difference between second place and 20th. He has held the first or second ranking on the continent since 2002, the year of his first national championship. He holds the record for the highest Scrabble rating ever achieved. He is such an overwhelming favorite this weekend that a popular fantasy Scrabble rotisserie competition places him on participants' selected teams automatically." So that I think does a good job of conveying the scale of his dominance.
Yeah, well, I screenshotted his Wikipedia. He's so dominant at Scrabble, he has a Wikipedia despite being renowned for his not wanting to talk to media or do interviews or anything like that. It says Nigel Richards, born in 1967, so he is like in his mid-20s at the time of this documentary, is a New Zealand Scrabble player who's among the most successful players of all time. He became world champion in 2007, repeated the feat in 2011, 2013, and 2018, being the only person to have won the world championship more than once. He's also a five-time U.S. national champion, including a four-peat from 2010 to 2013, and an 11-time champion of the Singapore Open Scrabble Championship, and 13-time winner of the King's Cup in Bangkok. So certainly, as far as my money would be concerned, the GOAT in the Scrabble world. And it's so cool that this documentary catches him in his literal first tournament ever in America.
And maybe that's why there isn't that focus on him, just because he is so shy and so reclusive. And you see him very briefly in that match against Joel at the end, where he's incredibly quiet and soft-spoken and courteous at the table. But he isn't TV material the way that Marlon is, for instance, or that some of these other guys are. And he has, and again, can't really describe the true majesty of this on an audio podcast, but his beard is magnificent. And as you say, he is a very reclusive person. It wouldn't surprise me if he just like lived in a cabin in the woods somewhere, you know, writing his manifesto or something, and had to be like, he doesn't seem like someone who, again, he's devoted his entire life to Scrabble, and it's paid off for him. He is the best in the world by an overwhelming margin, it sounds like.
He is the one person who can defensibly spend all of his time on Scrabble.
But in order for that to be profitable for him, he also needs other people who should not be spending all their time on Scrabble to be doing that too, so that these tournaments have enough participants in them to fill out those prize pools.
Right. And he brings up another thing that they touch on briefly in the film, but I've always found super interesting. And I remember back in the early 2000s watching this ESPN Scrabble tournament that they actually allude to in like the very end of this movie, where ESPN aired this like all-star Scrabble tournament in 2003, and the guy who won it didn't even speak English. And they referenced that in this movie, that many, many of the best players in the world don't even speak the language that of the tournaments that they're playing in. And actually, another thing that I saw on Nigel's Wikipedia is that he studied French for 9 weeks and then won the French national championship.
Obviously, because why not? But yeah, you see that as well in Spelling Bees too, where by and large, the best spellers, and in my one brief televised success at anything competitive, I was in the 2004 National Spelling Bee for the UK, and the best performing contestants by and large were all children of, you know, Indian doctors or people who had come in from abroad, and often their parents did not have a great grasp of English, but they were very determined that their kids would have this drive and the success at this thing, and they pushed them incredibly hard, and they studied, you know, they put the work in, and they were rewarded, and they honestly deserve to win that more than I did. And I imagine that, you know, these tired players that you see coming across the world to play Scrabble, you know, they, for as much as people like Matt and Marlon have put the hours in to study, there's something additional about it too, and it's not even your language. And even if these words were in common use, you would not be able to use them because, you know, your country doesn't speak that, you don't speak that, and yet you're showing up there anyway in this alien climate to do your thing.
Let's rewind to your epic televised failure. What word did you miss, Dom? I believe I know the answer to this, but just to reiterate.
Well, I wouldn't say that I miss it. I would say the dictionary.
Okay, yes, I do know it. Yeah.
Look, okay, I spelled meerkat with a C instead of a K, which is an accepted consensus spelling by basically every dictionary in the world that's in use for anything else, except for the one they decided to use for the spelling bee. So joke's on me, I guess. I failed. I didn't read the rules properly, but I'm a winner at heart. You know, I should have carried on.
Yeah, and just to reiterate, in case anyone missed that, that's meerkat, because apparently Dom has never seen The Lion King. Anyway, so let's, I guess, get into... one thing I actually loved is the park, Dom. We see a couple of scenes spliced into this movie where people are playing Scrabble in the park. We have Joe, the Army veteran, Jimmy, the pianist. We have the legendary Aldo, who beat Joe Edley the first time Joe came to the park. And then we get to see a rematch between the two of them. And that's very exciting. But Dom, the real standout from the park has got to be the homeless guy, right?
Well, not just him, but also Mr. Fuckhead from Tunisia. And yeah, I don't know who would play the homeless guy in this hypothetical remake, but that's going to be a much coveted role for sure.
Yeah, that I died when they're cutting between all these people in the park just kind of talking about Scrabble, and then they include a clip of this guy just screaming into the void about Mr. Fuckhead from Tunisia. It's really random, but perfect for the kind of tone I think they're trying to establish for environment.
We also meet the den mother, Chris, who she looks like she could be dressed up for a day at the races. You know, she could be a member of high society, and instead she's there with her glasses and her hat and her dress, and she looks stunning, and yet she's here in Central Park in this like grimy square that they've carved out for themselves with all of these slightly unstable Scrabble passes.
Yeah, I missed her name. I was trying to find her name. I did get Rita Noor plays in the park. She was actually the 1987 national champion of Scrabble. And maybe I'm heavily biased because of the amount of time I've spent in the poker world. And I'm guessing, Dom, in Magic, it's not too much different, where it is almost exclusively men. They frame this in the movie as... from like the women's perspective, oh, there are only six women in the top 50 in Scrabble. I would say, compared to the other game this useless, that is an enormous number of women who have found one reason or another to spend that much time committing to this.
Yeah, Scrabble is not too far behind the curve in that regard. And one of the other women who is there, I think, in the park as well, though it's unclear if she plays there regularly, is Lynn Cushman, who offers a theory to why that is. And she says that the women just don't have the same urge to dominate the way that the men do and prove themselves by competing in something. It's almost in a sense where, like, the fact that it is useless makes it more worthy to compete in, or in a way where you have to just be the best at something. And that's like a determinant of your pride and your manhood and so on. And for the women, it's just not the same thing. And anecdotally, in those kind of discussions, you do hear a lot of this, where you see among a lot of these gaming scenes, including in like the fighting games community and everything else, where there are kind of two main ways to gain respect. Almost, you can either just be the kind of guy who you go to anything and you're going to be accepted and welcome and be successful at it. So I'm not sure exactly who that would apply to in this documentary, but usually there's someone who fits the bill there. Maybe like Brian Cappelletto, who seems pretty well adjusted.
Stefan Fatsis.
Yeah, him too. Or someone else who we'll get to in a bit. I was saving the best for last there. So you can be that just... a universally successful person who is choosing to be successful as well in this one thing, or you can earn that respect by dominating this one particular field or subculture in a way that maybe you don't in other areas of life, but this is a way to compensate for that. And so that's going to apply to most of our main stars here. And so that dynamic, I think, is a very male thing. And for these, in some cases, like self-appointed misfits like Joel or Marlon or whoever, that is their way to kind of gain acceptance. It's like, yeah, maybe society at large kind of looks at them with furrowed brows, but within this one world, they can walk into the tournament hall and they're kings of their fiefdom. And especially for someone like Joel, who ends up winning nationals here, spoiler alert, and goes on to great success, it's like, it makes sense if you want to make this your entire life, if this is the one thing where you are not just respected, but revered.
Right. And that's why earlier on, I honestly wasn't really sure what you were talking about when you were saying Joel seems like the type to downplay any accolades he might deserve. I'm guessing if we could see some footage of Joel walking into the tournament the following year, he would not be downplaying that much.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can get more into that a little later on. Along the way here, Dom, we see a tournament in Stamford, Connecticut, and Matt Graham is your winner there. So that was a lot of fun to see. And then Brian Cappelletto wins yet another one of the prelims in. This is the part, Dom, that I really was most surprised to see make the final of this documentary, which is arrive in San Diego. Marlon decide that he's going down in Tijuana and off some steam a little bit. Does Matt Graham go with someone?
I think he offers Joel to come with him, and Joel declines, surprisingly.
Anyway, this is really the culmination here of Marlon just getting buried by this edit. My guy Marlon here is constantly, over the course of this movie, shown, like, immediately after he loses in any of these tournaments, they just smash cut to him going outside and smoking weed and talking about all the things he wish he'd done differently. When he goes to a local school in New York to, like, teach the kids about Scrabble, one of
not to interject, sorry, but that scene as well is so great and so well done too, where you have this very well put together teacher talking about hiring an expert to come in and talk to the kids and the role that Scrabble plays as this intellectual pursuit that is going to energize the kids and so on, and you're wondering exactly who this expert is. It's going to be some some coach in a suit or something, and then Marlon just swaggers into the frame very his usual get up, and you wonder how anyone okayed the idea of letting him in the building.
Yeah, Marlon's like trying to buy weed kids. But the kids are like asking him questions, and one of them says, "Are you a good sport when you lose?" And he goes, "Yeah, you know, I try to be a good sport." Smash cut to a highlight reel of Marlon like tilting his face off in five different tournaments right after losing. Incidentally, they also, I'll get to the Tijuana thing in a second, but they show him on the like first day of nationals sleeping through his alarm as they're just standing there filming him, not waking him up for this minute. They're just filming him sleeping through him.
I wish they had also filmed Marlon tilting off at them when he realized that he was in that situation.
I am so skeptical of their intentions after their treatment of Marlon that it wouldn't surprise me if they said, "Don't even bother setting the alarm. We'll wake you up tomorrow morning. Don't sweat it." And then that's what they did to him. But finally, in Tijuana, they literally follow him into Mexico, picking up a hooker, and then makes the fun of him talking about banging this hooker in Mexico.
But my guy Marlon was really done dirty here. Although, as many people have said in the context of reality TV editing, if you don't do it, they can't show it. So.
Yeah. Still, that seems like, I don't know what he thought the cameras were there for. That is absolutely, to some extent, on Marlon, but give me a break, dude.
And honestly, the idea of him inviting Joel to go with him for this night of debauchery is, for as much as there are some well-deserved criticisms to make of like the competitive Scrabble scene, or really the competitive blank scene, you know, choose a fill in there as you like. The fact that you can get someone like Marlon and someone like Joel voluntarily in the same room together on good terms, enjoying the same activity, that is the allure of the game, right? It's the fact that for as much as there are all of these barriers to entry, and you need to have a lot of spare time and money to make all of this worth pursuing or able to be pursued, the fact that you get these people who in any other context would never even meet each other or probably want to have anything to do with each other, and they're kind of friends in this weird way, like that's part of the magic of this, and that's what makes it special.
And I know this was not your point, but I do think you accidentally got to like the critical distinction between Scrabble and other games, I would say, which is Scrabble is never worth pursuing. It's just able to be pursued by some people,
right? And this is the underlying thing that goes into a lot of this. So when Matt wins that tournament, I believe he gets $1,000 for coming in first. And so that sounds like a decent payday. That's not a bad weekend at the office. But you look at what goes into that, and you have the entry fee, first of all, which I imagine has to be decently substantial to make first place at a small tournament worth $1,000. You then have travel costs. If you're spending the weekend there, then presumably you have to pay for a hotel or some other lodging. You have all of the costs associated with going to another city to do something. And I guess taxes as well on top of that. So you take all of this into account, he's not coming away with a massive reward for coming in first in that tournament. And if he didn't come in first, usually these payouts scale substantially. So second is far less than first, and then you go all the way down. If Matt makes, let's say, the quarterfinals of that tournament or whatever, he's probably losing money on the weekend. So this is something which you need to be independently financially stable in order to pursue. And it seems like certainly Matt, or rather probably Matt and definitely Marlon, are not financially stable independently. So they're finding a way to make this work somehow despite themselves. But it's not really self-sustaining. And these examples, you can find them anywhere, basically. So I'm a big fan of watching competitive Smash Brothers. And you hear about the competitive scene there. You have people like piling into cars to drive 12 hours to a different state for a tournament where if you win, you're still losing money on the whole thing. And a lot of the time, those communities, it's really heavily split economically between the kind of middle class, upper middle class people who can afford to take a loss, and they're treating this as a hobby where you expect to lose money, you expect to pay to take part in a hobby, and that's the money that they set aside and they're happy with that. And then also the people who are many rungs down, who really can't afford to be doing this or anything else, but this is what makes them happy. And so to escape from the drudgery of not having money elsewhere, they do this and just hope that it's going to work out somehow.
Right. And because first place in the national championship is worth $25,000 and one person is going to win that. But we'll see. Marlon gets fourth place for $800. And I'm guessing between whatever the buy-in is and travel and however much the hooker costs, that is going to mean losing money, even though there were 700 or so people and he did extraordinarily well. It seems like all but two or three of them are going to lose money on the weekend.
And you see the pickup games of Scrabble and like other semi Scrabble like games going on the side. A lot of the time, that's the main moneymaker. It's the action going place in the side rooms while everyone else is focused on the big screen. That's where the real money's at. And that's often the case in poker. I know it's, and I'm sure it's sometimes the case in Scrabble too.
Well, that was the thing, is I thought I had the exact same thing. Maybe the tournaments are not how they're making their money playing Scrabble. If they're playing high stakes cash games and they're the best players in the world, maybe that's totally viable. But when G.I. Joel laid out what the stakes were for one of the games he was playing, not the $1,000 match best of 50 against Matt that took all day and he got bought out of for like 500, but the cash game format, he said in a seemingly like, oh, this is the standard kind of way, he said, oh, we're just playing our normal 5 and 5, which is $5 a game and 5 cents a point, which even if you blow someone out for like hours at a time, you're going to have a hard time making more than a couple $100. And that's like best case scenario.
I did enjoy the scene where Matt visits Joe at his house and they're playing this marathon session of money matches for like a grand total or something. And then when Matt, as he attributes it to, just gets unlucky and is running dry and decides to forfeit, he tries to buy out or ask Joel to buy him out. And when Joel accepts his offer, Joel just like limply extends his hand as if, I'm really disappointed and ashamed that I have to be doing this, but you're my friend, so sure. And Matt's just sitting there, cradling his head in his hands, and Joel just sits there motionless with his hand outstretched, and eventually after a very long pregnant pause just like looks at the camera and retracts his hand. It really sums up how depressing this whole thing can be.
Yeah, I think I've said this sort of thing before, but there has never been a bigger lock. That was one of those blog pictures that you know it as soon as you see it, and I was happy dumb that you noticed that as well. As soon as I saw Joel with his hand outstretched as Matt is just like wincing in agony with his face in his palms, that was the lock of the decade to be the blog picture for this podcast episode.
I was going to use Marlon and the hooker, but sure, we can go with
okay.
That too.
All right, we don't need to do Marlon dirty the same way this editing team did. The only other thing I had before we get into the Nationals, Dom, is we get to meet G.I. Joel's dad along the way at the Reno tournament, and he is everything I ever dreamed of and more, rocking, much like his son, the suspenders and short-sleeve button-down shirt. He's got multiple pens in his breast pocket. He's really knocking it out of the park here as Joel's dad.
Yeah, big Mike Sherman fan. And I don't know how it happens so consistently that these minor characters, these family members who we see in so many of these documentaries, often seem like they should be the stars too, or they deserve their own spin-offs. And maybe it's that when you meet them for a prolonged period of time, they aren't that interesting anymore. But as these like tertiary characters, they really pull their weight.
Yeah, I think we kind of got robbed of an Alan Avery figure here.
For sure. Although we already have Hattie Hill, Mike Sherman's great. We never get to meet like Joe Edley's relatives or whatever, but I'm sure they have their own personality quirks too. So definitely room for a spinoff there if they want to revive this 15 years later.
Yeah, I felt bad for Joe's wife. Reminded me of like the Barkley Marathon wives and girlfriends that are just mm-hmm. trying to make sure their partner doesn't go insane over these 3 days.
Right. I want a Where Are They Now with Joe Ellie's kids to see how well they've integrated into society here as young adults.
I have some faith in Joe Ellie's kid. Maybe a little less so in Joe Edley himself to have integrated seamlessly into society. But let's get into, Dom, this national championship tournament, the main event that all of this has been leading up to. We have over 700 players and 25,000 to our eventual first place winner. And even though, and we've probably undersold this over the course of the podcast, just how kind of feared and revered Joe Edley is within the Scrabble community. And no one really would ever question him as one of the best in the world, at least at the time of this filming. When it comes to this national championship, he is not going to get off to too great of a start beyond the first day. He's in the mix for a little while, but from it really seemed like day two and three, the Zen factor was not there. He rallies back on the final day, but ends up finishing in 23rd. But with Joe aside, after the opening few rounds, all of the other three are in the top five entering day four. And I've got to imagine the documentary filmmakers must have been really excited about this result, having so many of these people still in the hunt.
Absolutely. And it almost makes it better if Joe Edley is the one to fail. It represents this changing of the guard, that it's not just going to be the same guy who won 20 years ago is back at it again. It's someone else. So like one of these other figures is keeping it competitive and making a run for the title. But before all of this, we first have to get to nationals. So we check in briefly with Matt and Marlon, who are separately taking a cross-country train to San Diego from the East Coast because they're both afraid to fly. And I don't know if this is a good way to hashtag date this documentary, given that this is mid-2002. You know, we're less than a calendar year removed from 9/11. And maybe that's behind some of their fear of flying here. Or maybe I could, it's certainly in Marlon's range to have some like conspiracy theory about planes being a tool of the government or something. Or yeah, I could definitely see there being other factors at play here beyond just time sensitive scaredness.
Do you remember 9/11? Like, was that news to you the day that it happened?
Yes, 9/11 was news to me the day that it happened.
Do you remember where you were?
I don't remember where I was. No.
Okay. How old were you? You would have been like 6.
I was a youthful 8, okay?
Right. That's still unacceptable, but glad to know it. Word at least got back to Dom, everybody. We can rest easy.
Yeah, they sent a carrier pigeon across the Atlantic, and the news made its way to us eventually.
All right, so yeah, that was fun that Marlon and Matt did not want to travel together, and I touched on this earlier, but just...
Although they are rooming together, seemingly for nationals, so yeah.
Yeah, they're rooming together now, and I am proposing that this podcast ends in just a supercut of all of the great Marlon quotes, many of which will be about Matt.
Yeah, I spent a solid half an hour before we started this going back and finding timestamps for all of the many, like the entire goldmine of Marlon quotes. So we'll be sure to dig out some of those. But Marlon's going to have a few more starring moments throughout here. So we'll get to those when we do. But one thing I do want to highlight quickly is after or between rounds, I guess, when you get these shots just outside the tournament hall, you see this entire cluster of young men is around this board, like loudly dissecting and yelling about this game of Scrabble. And you cut in the distance to this wife in full wedding regalia, just looking completely bemused and perturbed about what's going on, as if they're making a scene outside her perfect day. And the wedding is a classic example of this phenomenon, which again you see this in poker, magic, just any competitive activity where if it's taking place in a convention center, usually these are all fully booked up. So you go into one hall and you have the tournament was one thing going on, and then you go next door and it's like an entirely different universe. There's usually some like trade show or corporate event, or there's some other thing which is a completely different universe to whatever you're doing. So in my time, I've seen like cheerleading conventions, quilting seminars, these things where the demographics as well are totally different. So you can get on like the convention center shuttle bus, and on one side you have a bunch of like young men in their mid-20s with backpacks on, and on the other side you have school age girls in cheerleading outfits, or old women in strollers and Zimmer frames and everything. It's this really interesting contrast in worlds. And so it does not surprise me at all to see this loud, frenetic national Scrabble tournament of all things, right next to this very by-the-books wedding, which, you know, now is no longer going according to plan based on what this wife is saying.
I played a couple years ago in a backgammon tournament at a hotel in Boston, and the other half of the people staying in the hotel were there for like a country music concert, like Keith Urban or some like arena country endeavor that was like, it could not have been a more different personality type.
Yeah, I think that the best one that I've seen was I was in the Excel Center, so like the largest convention center in London, and right next to the hall I was in, there was Summit in the City, which is this annual like YouTube concert. So it's a bunch of celebrity YouTubers who themselves are teenagers, all of their even younger teenage or not even teenage yet fans, and their much beleaguered parents trying to stop any disaster from happening while they're there. So just seeing this like procession of people going back and forth was really just a bizarre sight to behold.
Yeah. All right, back to tournament. We resume on day four with Matt Graham losing a very close match, 437 to 32 after all the tiles are down, but went 10 seconds over on his clock, which means minus 10 points for every minute you go over. And even if you don't go the full minute, it's still the full 10 points. So he is going to end up losing that one and then going on to lose 8 of his next 9. And maybe that was influencing what I was saying earlier about Matt Graham potentially tilting a little harder than the average bear, but it definitely seemed like he may have come unglued here.
Yeah, and this is something as well that less so in poker, where the structure of a tournament doesn't really lend itself to this, but anything where you have the same thing iterated a bunch of times, you're playing a lot of rounds, or it allows you to keep playing to the end. What you see a lot, and this is definitely true in Scrabble, as we see with Matt, is someone is doing well and they're on the precipice of like breaking through to the next level or the next stage in the tournament, and they miss, and then they just go into this tailspin where they just lose.
Yeah.
A bunch of rounds, and it really just ends in complete disaster for them.
Yeah, we see Joe Edley cannot get anything going on days two or three, but he rallies on day four and ends up finishing in 23rd place. Matt Graham goes from fifth to 55th place on day four. Missed work there, but what can you do? Marlon is putting in impressive work. He ends up making it to game. The winner will end up playing 31 games. Marlon makes it to the game 27. However many people are left at that point, he is eliminated by G.I. Joel. I guess he gets fourth place. And I felt really, really bad for Marlon when it shows the like real-time action of him passing on his turn and swapping out like A, E, 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 O. And then it shows him picking up his new tiles one at a time. And it's A, 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 E, I. And like he swaps five vowels for five different, just lost, and just stands up, lets his clock run, and goes outside. Probably smokes a joint.
Yeah, with those tiles, you could spell the primal scream that Marlon gives after redrawing the same tiles for a second time. So yeah, that is definitely him being on the wrong end of variance there. And it's interesting that Marlon, I have to imagine, is the only Ghanaian citizen playing in this tournament. You know, we have Nigel Richards holding it down for New Zealand, but it's good to see a wide, diverse representation here.
Yeah, and I misspoke. Marlon goes out in eighth place, not fourth place. So no one really cares either way. But there goes Marlon, eliminated at the hands of G.I. Joel, who actually ends up finding himself in the finals here against Nigel Richards, the New Zealand everyone is very nervous about now that he's playing in America. And I remember, Dom, the first time I watched this movie, rooting against Joel, like rooting for him to lose, because I just was not a huge fan of the vibe that he gave off over the course of this whole time. And
yeah, I remember this. I remember being aghast that you this Joel hater, but I can't even remember the excuse you gave at the time now.
I don't remember that, but I remember being surprised that you loved him so much. That yeah, your reaction was like, how could you not root for Joel? I was over the moon when he won.
It's not that I loved him, it's just that he was a convincing underdog, I thought, and it was good to see him finally get a break.
He's an interesting character that I agree is a sympathetic figure to see finally catch a break, for sure, but I found him, I guess, less sympathetic in the build-up to that than you did.
Okay, well, I has he made a believer out of you now?
I mean, it's not. It was never an issue not believing in Joel as a Scrabble player. I will happily grant that Joel is a world-class Scrabble player. I just never got the same sense. It sounded at least like you did when we were setting these characters up in the beginning that Joel had much humility when it came to Scrabble.
Sure, yeah.
And that, yeah, and again, it's not like being like the number one key to my heart. It just...
I know.
Yeah, thank you. All right, whatever, Dom. You don't need to attack our co-hosts as we're trying to wrap Scrabble tournaments, okay?
Fair enough. It is worth, before we build to this dramatic climax here, that there are some other things going on in the periphery of this tournament hall. So at one point in this 30-game marathon stretch, Matt has to play against Marlon, and he once again plays a phony, which Marlon doesn't call at the time, only finds out about afterwards, and... It's not clear if it actually had an impact on the game, but either way, Marlon is not happy about it.
Just to quickly clarify, a phony is, it is legal in Scrabble to play a word does not actually exist. As long as it doesn't call you on it, it counts.
Yeah, so it's not just a desperate gambit to get a few points. Sometimes it's also just like this psychological power move, right? If you think that you can get one past your opponent, that it's definitely in Matt's range to do that, just to needle Marlon a little bit. And if you want a taste of their symbiotic misery, as he put it, I think Matt contributes to that a little bit. And let's get Marlon's brief take on that too.
Matt must have saved my life or some shit in a previous life. That's the only fucking way. You know, I can't imagine why I'm still friends with that motherfucker. The stupid motherfucker put down a bogus word on me. A phony. And I told him, you're building up bad karma, you know, with your behavior. You know, and then he said, well, you're an idiot and an asshole. But that was just the beginning. Sure enough, this motherfucker asked me for money after the tournament. I'm like, fool, you lucky I'm not whipping your dumb ass right now.
So I'm sure that's just one incident in what I'm sure will be a long and successful friendship after this point. They'll patch it up, they'll hug it out, they'll go for drinks, and all will be good at the end.
Yeah, as I mentioned, my friends played Words with Friends, which is done through like your phone. And on that game, you're not allowed to play bogus words, but I am positive if I got into Scrabble, this rule would be the death of me. I'm constantly trying to get away with playing both of my bad tiles.
And with that whole symbiotic misery thing, I don't know if it's just Matt being around Marlon or if it's just the relationship the two of them have that brings out the worst in both of them. But for as much as Matt seems normal-ish a lot of the time, he gives this like truly deranged monologue when he's in the car with Marlon, I think heading to this tournament. So let's roll that quickly.
Oh, yeah.
People are so pathetic. I mean, I want to have a good life. But beyond that, man, whatever happens to this planet, I mean, blowing up is too good for this planet. People should just suffer. I'm still trying to work it out where I'll be, you know, causing a lot of the suffering and not suffering myself. That's what I'm working on.
You're working on being Joe Adley.
No, he causes such small-scale suffering.
I can't.
I mean, that monologue honestly terrified me. I was very nervous about Matt Gray's well-being.
And for just as disturbing as that sounds, I will say that he causes such small-scale suffering. It's a truly elite burn, really, that someone like Joe Edley probably is deserving of.
Right, yeah. So we have our finals here of Nigel and Nigel for the kind of finishing blow. A genius-esque almost montage of Joel looking at his rack and kind of unscrambling the letters. Maybe not the genius. Maybe it's more like that Zach Galifianakis gif from The Hangover of like all the math symbols just kind of floating in the air in front of his face.
No. I'm pretty sure the genius is the only and perfect comparison for basically anything.
Not going to acknowledge. I'm not biting. I'm done with that for Dom, so try a lot. And I want to show us, they don't show us a rack. They just pop a bunch of letters up onto the screen. And the reason for that is they actually make the degree of difficulty here look a lot harder than it is. We actually can see playing these tiles that one of them was a blank and he didn't necessarily need it to be an S or whatever. But it was still cool to see him play 10 years for a championship winning bingo, clearing his whole rack and winning by a pretty deciding margin. The whole auditorium are applauding as G.I. Joel comes just pipes in once again. That was really, really good and well done. Nothing's going to change G.I. Joe's world other than potentially going on the Today Show and feeling like a celebrity. But at the end of the tournament, we have our champion. And as much as I may have been rooting against him during the buildup, I did like how this was unveiled. And I was happy to see him ultimately come away successful.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know how the documentary changes and the whole lead up to this changes if, let's say, Matt wins or, God forbid, Marlon wins. I think that would be that would offer them a true cornucopia of highlights for their edit.
We're coming back
edit.
To Tijuana, gang. Let's go.
Oh, yeah. Everyone's invited. Everything's on me. Let's go. But even if, let's say, Nigel Richards wins, or even just some random person you can't fashion that kind of storyline around, I wonder if they would still find a way to make this ending convincing. So close and seeing what he's dreamed of in his sights and then just missing out. You can build a story around that heartbreak, but with the overall tone of the documentary, I guess it's something of a balanced edit, right? Like, it wasn't clear to me going in that Joel had to win or that one of these guys had to take it down for everything before this to make sense. So I like that you had a few plausible winner candidates coming into the finale. But I think Joel winning is the ideal ending, and I'm glad that it's the one we got, even if you weren't at the time, Colin.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, from the filmmaking perspective, that would be the outcome I would be rooting for. So I'm happy to see them get their way there. And I don't want to take too much away from Joel. I am, with all of these years now that have passed since seeing this, I'm very readily accepting that this is the perfect outcome. So there you have it. G.I. Joel is your national champion of Scrabble. He gets the $25,000 prize. And that is the end of Word Wars, Dom. And so at this point, we have maybe one or two other things to just kind of wrap up along the way. But I want to get your rating of this documentary on a scale of 1 through 10. So I'm going to say from, I wish I knew which Scrabble tiles were worth 10. Which ones are worth 10? Is X worth 10?
I want to say the Q is worth 10.
I think Q is worth 10. X may be worth 8. So I think J is worth 10 and X is worth 10. So give me on a scale of A, how many points this is worth?
I'll give it a solid J. I really did enjoy this one a lot.
I didn't mean to. I'm not willing to go full J here. But I will give it, if X is worth 8, I'll give it an X. I'm going to give this an X out of 10. Things pop up, just kind of updating us on these people and where they go afterwards. My plan is to get the hell away from Scrabble. I'll play in Washington, but these tournaments aren't for me. And we get a little image on screen popping up to tell us, he entered his next tournament 2 weeks later. So a perfect kind of send-off for Marlon there.
And if you look at the Scrabble equivalent of the Hendon Mob database, which tracks all of someone's tournament participation and finishes, Marlon still very active through 2018 and 2019, as it turns out. So he hasn't been able to quit just yet.
I would expect nothing less. I'm glad to hear it. I did want to say that the final kind of like title card that pops up, that's not a title card, but that sort of process kind of setting the expectations a little higher, the future of Scrabble, where they, after the big tournament and all that's been said about how the real issue is just prize money, they say, hey, and in 2003, ESPN, for the first time ever, aired a Scrabble All-Star tournament with $50,000 to first place, more than twice as much as first place just got for this one here. And the message, it seemed to me, was kind of intended to be, hey, things are looking up for the world of Scrabble. And I believe I've already said, I remember watching that. I remember Lon McCarron doing play-by-play for it, one of the normal poker co-hosts, who also, by the way, in 2003, was on ESPN talking about Chris Moneymaker, who got poker like a year before, $1 million, playing against the best players in the world as a total amateur. And I think that may have had something to do with Scrabble not potentially catching on, people being able to see just how much easier the money was in poker.
And yeah, no equivalent Sherman effect going on here. I don't think all of the people watching on their couches at home were inspired to hit up the local Scrabble Club by Joel's marvelous finish.
I went out and bought 5 bottles of Pepto-Bismol to get in the right state of mind.
Yeah, but there's one other person I think we should check in on too here, because as a way of illustrating the futility of Scrabble as a career, or really just as a hobby in general, they interview this charming young man named Andre Ornish, who I'll let him give his own words here.
Yeah, I'm 11 years old and I've been playing for 2.5 years.
You looking like maybe you want to sit over there in Division 1 someday?
Maybe, I don't know. I don't want to get like super obsessed where I don't like have a job.
And so for the final Where Are They Now of this episode, let's check in with Andre Ornish here in 2019.
So my name is Andre Ornish. I'm the founder and CEO of Luna. And Luna's a new online dating platform built with blockchain and machine learning in order to better optimize user experience and ultimately find people better connections.
So I will leave it to the listener to decide for themselves if having a blockchain dating app is something which is going to be a better use of your time when you look back at this on your deathbed than playing Scrabble for a living. But I guess different strokes for different folks, I suppose.
I mean, a better use of your time than doxing 11-year-old Scrabble players?
It's not doxing. I just typed his name into Google. He's the one doing the self-promotion.
Okay,
here.
All right. So yeah, there you have it, Dom. What a treat it was to talk through Word Wars. I don't even know if we have one particular title planned for where to go next, but I definitely do hope that during the Survivor off season we can not be too long between these documentary episodes. These are a lot of fun to be doing pretty much every time, even just pretty much every time. I'm going to say
that's the spirit. Me too, I suppose. What should we leave this with? There are so many good Marlon quotes that we could finish this out with. Do we want to just do an entire compilation, or is there a choice one that you have in mind?
I don't have any choice ones in mind, but you have so many written down here on your notes that I'm going to leave it to you to send us home with what I'm sure will be a thrilling Marlon compilation.
And so here to guide us out is the pre-Meccan Malcolm Scrabble himself talking about the English language and really everything else under the sun.
They wanted me to learn German for some fucking reason. And I was like, you know, no way. No way. English is hard enough. The language is going to have the characteristics of the people that speak it. If the people is inconsistent, the language is going to be inconsistent. If the people is fucking greedy, take shit no matter where they go, the language is going to take shit no matter where it go. The language is a reflection of the people.